Well, good evening. We have been together for 5 lessons now, many of you, and I want to express my appreciation, especially to those who have been here every service and have sat patiently and listened to my outpouring of enthusiastic speech. If there's any topic about which we have to be enthusiastic, I think it is about our families, and I appreciate your attention. I appreciate each and every one of you who kind of be with us this evening. And I want to give a special word of commendation to the translators. Believe me, I've been aware of the burden that I placed on. They have struggled on. Hopefully, you know, I have not been tired them out too much. And I want to thank Luke, too. He has worked really diligently between services to make sure that he's gotten the Spanish translation on the slides. So I thank you all for the way in which you've contributed. And really, too, I thank you for letting me be a part of what's going on here. It is just such an encouragement to come in the building, hear the enthusiasm with which you greet one another in a conversation. Again, after the services are over, I just appreciate being a part of that. And then some of you have even gone beyond that and have had me in the homes, and the conversations have been so encouraging to me. I know this doesn't seem maybe the way that I am, but I am humbled by the fact that you've invited me, humbled by the way in which you've received these lessons. And I appreciate so much that you are concerned about the issue of having godly families. We've been 3 lessons, first of all, on families in general. When we talked about the biblical definition for the family, we talked about love in the family, and then we talked about the characteristics of strong, godly families. And then this morning, we talked about specifically how to build a biblical marriage using 1 Peter chapter 3. And now this evening, we turn our attention to the specific topic of raising godly children. And of course, this is a topic that concerns every single parent or parent-to-be, grandparents as well in this day and age. Many people ask me, you know, how can we raise godly children, especially in the environment in which we live today? The presumption seems to be that it's more difficult to raise godly children today than it has been in the past. If you were to ask parents, do you think it's more difficult today? I think the overwhelming majority would say, yes, it's more difficult today than it has been in the past. And then I think to myself, well, what about Christians in first century Corinth? Well, that had to be a pretty tough task. And what about Adam and Eve? They actually had one son murder another son. And God forbid that we should experience that kind of tragedy in our own homes. We do have this tendency, of course, to think of this as the best of times and the worst of times. But whether it is better or worse than it has been in the past, that does not give us an excuse to abdicate the responsibility we have to our children, nor does it give us the excuse to just go ahead and bear down on our children in such a way that we think it's going to be okay with our children, regardless of what we do. We have a responsibility to concern ourselves with our children and raise them in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. So there are a lot of ways in which I can approach this lesson. There are many avenues of consideration about raising godly children. And I choose this way, that we should ask ourselves, what do we owe to our children? The fact of the intersection of the dependency of children and the selfishness of adults, whether in the first century or the 21st century, creates a need for us to think about our children in this way, our obligations. What do we owe to our children? They didn't ask to be brought in the world. We chose to bring them home. And I don't suggest, you know, some of you teenagers going to your dad and say, I didn't ask to be brought into the world, so you have to be really nice to them about it. I'm pretty sure if we gave them the opportunity, would you want to be born, they would say yes. But we have, in fact, brought them into the world. And because of our resources and their lack of resources, our adult status and competency versus their independence and their helplessness, we have an obligation to And we ought to think about those obligations. First obligation, the first thing that we owe to our children is to think about them in the right way. We need to have a right attitude toward our children. Why do we have children anyway? What is it that causes people to bring children into the world, especially in this day and age where we have adequate means of contraception? Why do you have children? And a lot of people don't have a really good answer for that. But the way in which they conduct themselves toward their children, you get the sense somehow that they brought those children into the world to satisfy some kind of selfish ambition on their part. They want to be able to brag about their children. They want to relive their childhood through their children. Maybe, unfortunately, we put this burden on our children. We want them to do better than we did when we were children their age. We have some kind of selfish objectives in bringing children into the world. But that's not the attitude that is displayed in the scripture toward children. The Bible says about children in Psalm 127 and verse 3 through 5, and other places would indicate the same kind of attitude. Children are a heritage from the Lord. And of course, as is many occasions in the scripture, behold, look on it carefully. Children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward, like the arrows in the hand of a warrior. So are the children of one's youth. Happy is the man who has his quiver full of them. They will not be ashamed, but shall speak with their enemies in the gate. Children are a blessing, and we ought to think of them as the kind of blessing that God has given to us. And particularly we recognize that when we see parents who so desperately want to have a children, and for some reason or another, they are not able to bring children into the world. We ought to celebrate every day, not just on the day the child is born, but we ought to celebrate every day in which that child is in our lives, because God has blessed us with his child. And you recognize, too, the significance of the fact that we say children are our heritage. Our heritage. One of the points that I tried to make on the very first evening we were together is that family is a means of generational responsibility. We take what we've been given from the past and we pass it on to the future. That the children are the future and they are our future, and they're the record of what we've done in our lives. Some people may write books. Some people may build edifices. Some people may establish wealth and do something with that. But the most important kind of heritage we will leave is in our children. Somebody asked this question. If you could write one sentence right now and preserve it in a time capsule, and it would last long after you've gone, one sentence, one letter, perhaps a page, what would you write? Well, in some ways, if you have children, you're already writing that letter. Apostle Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 2 about those whom he has begotten in the Lord, you are our letter, written in our hearts and known and read by all men. How do we evaluate the success of our life? We evaluate the success of our life when all is said and done, probably much more in our children than any other way. This letter that we are writing as parents is going to be read by lots of people. I've had the privilege, the honor over 44 years working with Florida College. And maybe when I first began, I didn't understand quite what the importance of that was or the honor of that. But I've seen parents bring their children to Florida College, and then those children bring their children to Florida College. And I get some sense, you know, of what the importance of this generational responsibility, this heritage is that people are able to pass on to the future. And sometimes a child is graduating and the parents will come in and say, oh, we're so glad to finally meet you. You know, we've heard so much about that. And I say, well, I know about you too, because I know your children. I know your children, and that tells me something about who you were. It is the heritage that we pass on to the future. And if we want to be successful, we pass on successful children into the future. I think this is the case, that you can't be really considered a success in life, no matter what else you may accomplish, if you're not been successful in your children. And that's the sad thing to me as I read the scriptures about Eli. the priest and his children and the way in which they conducted themselves in that immoral way. And then Samuel, who had that example right in front of him, let the same thing happen to his children. And David, that great man of faith, there's nothing to brag about in most of his children. What is it that crowns old age more than children and grandchildren who are living the way they ought to live? And what more difficult task than to raise children in such a way that they are going to be successful? Some people work in metal. Some people blow fragile glass. Some people write sonnets that requires some kind of intellectual capacity. But nothing requires more skill than raising children to be successful people, to be godly people in this world. And you think about the significance of that. Jesus points out the significance of being a parent in Mark 9, verse 36, where he takes that child. And he sets that child before him. And he says, whoever receives one child like this in my name receives me. And it's like we get many lessons out of that. Think about it from the point of view of a parent. Here's the child that God has given us. You receive this child, you receive Christ himself. They are important. Martin Luther's teacher was really one of those old-fashioned, old-style, gruff, kind of harsh sort of teachers, and he would strive through the village. Everybody had considerable respect for him, and the people would say hello or hi or whatever they would say in those days, and he just ignored them entirely until he came to the child. And he would come to that child. He would bow to that child and speak to the pleasant. And the adult said, why are you so pleasant to the children and not to us? And he said, well, we already know what you're going to be. We don't yet know what these children are going to be. We don't know. We need those children to grow up and to be what they can be. We owe them the right attitude. And we owe them security. Children are so helpless when they come to the world. And even when they get to be old enough that they think they're not helpless anymore, they really are in some ways helpless. And we have an obligation to provide for their security. First of all, their physical security. We need to protect them, take care of them, hold them and cuddle them when they're young. That's a thing that just comes naturally to most of us. But we need to try and keep them safe, keep them away from harm. And of course, part of that harm is not just the harm of the physical things that can happen, but their fear of those physical things. And we need to take their fear seriously about that. Even if we look silly by taking the flashlight in the middle of the night and looking under the bed or opening up the closet and searching through it, we want to keep them safe. We want to make them feel safe. We need to have some concern about their physical safety, but much more about their mental safety. Here's the lesson I think I learned over the years. It's really difficult. As a Christian, we have so frequently say no to our children about moral issues. You can't do that. You can't go with those other kids to those kind of places because we're concerned about the crowd. Maybe we ought to loosen up a little bit sometimes about the physical dangers that we're so much concerned about. You know, let them build a treehouse. They fall out and break their arm, then, you know, we could get that mended probably. But we need to protect them in the right way, and particularly protect them probably about this concerns, these anxieties, these fears that they have. You know, you don't understand the mind of a child. My son was probably 35 years old before he told me of this terrible anxiety he used to have when he was riding in the back seat of the car, and we would have the windows open, breeze blowing through. And, the wind blows pretty rapidly going down the highway, and there'd be one of these paper bags in the bottom, plastic bags just circulating around it. Out the window it would go. And he thought, oh, no, that's going to happen to me. I never had any idea. We need to try and keep them safe. Yeah. Keep them safe in their own mind. Really, nobody understands that stuff except for Mr. Bob, He sang that song about you can never go down, never go down, never go down in the bathtub, right? Who would think? But we need to pay attention to them and provide them with this kind of security and emotional security. They need to feel loved and have no doubt whatsoever about the love that we have for them. The best thing we can do for our children, that which is most directly related to their happiness, is for us to be a happy family, for the parents to be happy with one another. Don't give those children any sense of this is a fragile enterprise and it might fall apart at any moment. One of the kind of sappy things that people write so many of about this suggests that the family is like a book. Children are the leaves, the parents are the covers, which full protection give. Love is the golden clasp that binds it all in one. Break it not, lest the leaves be scattered and gone. We owe our children that sense of emotional security. We need to endow in them the sense of we are committed to them no matter what. And a part of that is the kind of affection that we owe them. We need to provide for them the love that generates that sense of security. And of course, it's in so many things, the model that we have in this way is the model of our Father in heaven who loves us. Jesus makes this kind of significant point, but we turn it upside down as so many of the lessons are. He can be telling us about his love for us, but he also tells us about the kind of love that we have for our children. When he says, what man is there among you who if the son asks for bread, but give him a stone? Probably even among those people that day, there were some that would be. But his point is saying, that's not the way it ought to be. If your son asked for bread, you wouldn't give him a stone. He asked for a fish, you wouldn't give him a serpent. If you, being as evil as you are, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father, who is in heaven, give good gifts to those who ask him? And we learn from that the important lesson of our Father's love for us and his desire to do for us when it's in our own best interest. But we also learn from that, or need to learn from that, that's the way we ought to deal with our children. We ought to love them enough to do what is in their own best interest every single time. And when they ask us for something and it's right, honorable, doesn't put them in any danger, doesn't infringe on their moral development or their self-discipline, we ought to do that as much as we can. We need to love them. You shouldn't be having to tell parents that. And when you see parents with their newborn child, you just, you don't feel like you ever have to tell them that you need to love that child. But the new wears off. The day-to-day comes and takes hold. The irritations arise. And somehow they seem to forget that this is that precious child they prayed to God for and he's given to them. That's why in Titus chapter 2 and verse 4, talking about the various responsibilities we have in the congregation to one another, Paul says that the older women should admonish the younger women, that they would love their husbands and love their children. We need sometimes to be reminded about loving those children. And of course, sometimes we say, as we go about our spouse, say, our children, well, they ought to know them. Well, how are they going to know them? If we don't tell them that, we don't show them that on a day-to-day basis. And here's one of the terrible things that parents do to their children. They communicate to that child the idea of conditional love. I'll love you as long as you're good. I'll love you if you do what I want you to do. I'll love you if you're a good student. I'll love you if you're popular. I'll love you if you practice hard at the sport that I've chosen for you. No wonder teenagers suffer pangs of anxiety and self-doubt with that kind of conditional sort of love in the background. They need our love even when they don't deserve it. That's in fact the way the Lord treats us. Romans 5 and verse 8. God demonstrates, doesn't just say, demonstrates his own love toward us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. We don't deal with one another that way. We deal with one another on this kind of contractual basis. If you do this, then I'll do this for you. That's not what family is about. Children need love even when they least deserve it, especially when they least deserve it. And that means, I think, in some ways, treating them with respect. We shouldn't be treating them always with sarcasm or with ridicule or rudeness. We need to be courteous to their children. We need to treat them with dignity. Even judges handing down the harshest sentence from the bench rarely resort to sounding like screaming harpies as they're dealing with the criminals. And yet parents so frequently descend to that when they're dealing with their children. We owe them our time and our companionship. Too many parents in the world today try to give their children everything except themselves. They work extra hours in order to make some money so they can buy them just the right kind of clothes or just the right kind of computer or send them to the right kind of school. Those things are important. Maybe more important is that we spend time with them. I don't know if this is true or not, but you think about Samuel and the way his sons ended up, and you wonder if that might be due to what we read in 1 Samuel chapter 7 and verse 16. That he went year to year on the circuit to Bethel and Gilgal and Mizpah, and he judged Israel in all of those places. Was he so busy with that work, which was a good work, that he didn't attend to his own children and his own family? We need to spend time with our children. Some fathers say, you know, I spend all day at work, slaving, trying to make ends meet. Then you think I'm supposed to come home and play games with those kids too? Well, yes, you brought them into the world. That's what they need. They need your time. They need you to take care of them and spend time with them. And that doesn't mean giving up your parental status that you spend time playing. I discovered this a long time ago, and it used to be relevant, probably not today. Anybody know his name, Ricardo Montalban? Khan, in the Wrath of Khan. But whatever kind of person he was, whatever kind of father was, he published this open letter that he supposedly wrote to his son. Dear son, as long as you live in this house, you will obey the rules. When you have your own house, then you can make your own rules. In this house, we don't have a democracy. I didn't campaign to be your father. You didn't vote for me. You're father and son by the grace of God. And I accept that privilege and also the responsibility. And accepting it, I have an obligation to perform the role of father. I am not your power. Our ages are too different. We can share many things, but we're not pals. I'm your father, and that's 100 times better than what any pal will be. I think we need to understand that because some parents fall into the trap of spending time with their children, but as equals. We're not equals. They don't need another friend, another pal. They need a father. So many need that. And in this day and age, in which husbands and wives both are working, we need desperately to spend time with our children. It's important to them in ways that we don't even see. And times past, men used to keep journals, not diaries. Women keep diaries, men keep journals. But they used to keep journals, particularly, you know, some of the prestigious people that we read about in history today, they kept a journal. And there was a diplomat, an American diplomat in Britain, who was keeping a journal. And his son sees him keeping a journal, so he tries to keep a journal too. And so it's interesting, you know, well, not really all that interesting, but occasionally, to compare what the father writes and what the son writes. And one day, the son writes in his diary, and the father writes in his diary. And his father writes, wasted the day, spent it fishing with the son. And the son writes, best day of my life, I went fishing with my dad today. It is magical when we spend time with them. And when we spend that time with them, we need to listen to them. As well as talk to them. We need to spend all that time talking to them as we walk by the way, as we go in the fields, as we go in the fishing boat, as we go on to errands. We need to spend that time talking to them, explaining the world to them. We need to listen to them as well. Because listening says to them, you're important. We say sometimes, my children never tell me anything. How many times have you asked kids to prepare y'all? Know the answer to this. What'd you do today? Nothing. What you learn in school today? Nothing. Well, that was a waste of time, then, wasn't it? Well, of course, that's the easy way to get out of the conversation. My children never tell me anything, people say, and probably the reason for that is we don't really listen to them. If we'd listen to them when they were telling us stuff that was important to them, they might be willing to tell us things that are important to ourselves. We need to listen to our children when they talk. I was talking to a man a few years ago, and he was talking about the problems that he had with his teenage son. And he was talking about this particular conversation he asked, an illustration of that. And he told me in great detail, exactly quoting himself, what he said to his son. And I'm listening and listening. He keeps telling me all the things he told his son. And I said, well, what did your son say to you? Nothing. He said, wait a minute. You know, maybe he didn't say a word. Maybe he was mute. But I'm pretty sure he probably said something. You just didn't listen to him. You got to go home and listen to that child. You got to hear what they have to say. You got to develop that habit when they're young. And this is like amazing memories for me. When my kids were small, they just chatter all the time. You know, you can't shut them up. You know, why, Danny? Why is this stick to the refrigerator? Because it's a magnet. Why is it a magnet? Because all the molecules are lined in the same direction. Why, Danny? And, you know, they just talk all the time. And if you want to know what's going on in people's homes, teach the small children's Bible classes. They won't say it. They won't. But, you know, after a while, you're like, I've got to concentrate. I need to focus on my thing. But you need to listen to them and develop that habit and maintain that habit as they get into their teenage years. Because then that's when you want to hear what they have to say. And you better still have that habit of them talking to you at that point in time. That habit has to be nurtured or it disappears. We really need to listen to them. And we owe the right kind of example. Given the natural tendency of devolution as opposed to the mythical idea of evolution in the world in which we live today, children are unlikely to be better than their parents without some kind of considerable effort. My dad used to say, and I tried to parse this, and I just heard it and didn't, you know, really think too much about it, but, you know, I tried to parse this in later years. People would praise him for his sons, and he would say, not much of a man who can't raise a son better than himself. And I think to myself, you know, that was kind of a compliment. I guess he was trying to, you know, say those kids are, you know, doing great. I don't want to take too much responsibility for that. But in contrast to that, I think it takes quite a man to raise children who are better than he is. The quality of the parents really approximates in some ways the quality of the child. That's that letter we send down into the world that's read by all men. That's why when I meet the parents, finally, of the children who've been in my class for a year or 2 years or 4 years at Florida College, I know them. I know the kind of person you are because I know the quality of a child that you've raised. We set the example for them. And one of the things that's characteristic of that, we want to teach them how to behave. But the best way to teach them is by example. Albert Schweitzer said, example is not the best teacher, it's the only teacher. Sometimes we have that expression, I can't hear what you're saying because your example is speaking too loudly. The children follow in our footsteps. They try and stand like we do. I remember a woman at the congregation many years ago, and she was looking at her child over there. She's, you know, had her hands on her hip and top of her foot, shaking her head. And she said, I just don't know what you're getting to me. Everybody else did. They just follow in our footsteps. And, you know, if you're going to tell the child a rule and then you break them, then you better have a pretty good explanation. And sometimes, you know, that will, like, if you think to yourself, how in my mind am I going to explain to this child that they have this rule and I don't have to live by that rule, maybe you decide it's not worth it. Let's just give it up and set the right example for them. Parents that try and tell their children don't use drugs, and then they themselves are using those kind of psychological dependency and crutches, you know, they're going to have a hard time building that in. I know one man who told his sons they could use any language that he does. That's a pretty daunting principle. And of course, they will call you on it pretty fast. Conversation the other day with a couple of my grandsons, and they were talking to their dad, and he was talking to me, and they were listening, and then they pipe up and say, we're not supposed to take the name of the Lord in vain, are we? And he said, no, clearly not. And he said, well, you just said about those people that were godless. Well, that wasn't vain. That's really powerful. We need to be careful, perhaps, about using that. But you have to explain it to them. They follow our example. Jesus taught us by example. That's why God came into the world, took on the form of flesh, so we could see how his character and his morality is to be expressed. The crux of the whole problem, one essayist said, for a father, is not, am I in charge of my family, but am I in charge of myself? Because only then can you be in charge of a family. We owe our children these things. And of course, yes, you knew I was going to get to this one. We owe them discipline. That's one of the fundamental responsibilities that we have to our children, is to discipline them. But in order to do so, we've got to properly understand what that means. Give that to the translators. Discipline comes in two varieties. It's really kind of a continuum. Sometimes when we say discipline, we think about punishment and only think about punishment. But discipline really is a matter of instruction and then correction. This doesn't do any good to correct them when you haven't previously instructed them. In fact, the word discipline comes from the same root word as disciple. We're discipling our children. And to disciple them, we have to give them the right example and give them the right instruction. And sometimes, yes, we do have to correct them when they have failed to follow that example and those instructions. And when we think about it that way, you know, it makes a whole lot more sense, not only to us, but also to the children. Nothing creates anger in children more rapidly than the fact that we're punishing them for something they didn't know was wrong, because we haven't given them enough instruction about that. It also helps to think about what the goal of discipline is. The ultimate goal of our having children and our responsibility and instructing them and correcting them is that they will be self-disciplined. They will learn how to control themselves. And we help them along that path by our own discipline. And when we think about, here's the end result, it changes to some extent the things that we're going to end up instructing them in and the way in which we're going to correct them. One of the things you have to learn with children is, at each age, you've got to give them some level of responsibility, some range of decision-making that's appropriate to the level of maturity. And as they get older, they have more room to make more decisions. And of course, that means they have more room for making more mistakes and doing things that we disapprove of. But you're going to have to take that risk if they're ever going to be self-disciplined adults. The CEO of Google had a speech a couple of weeks ago, and he summed up what really is the central element, I think, of leadership in business or leadership in the household, when he said that you need to reinforce your employees for effort, not just for performance. That when we are raising our children, we need to reward them when they tried, not just when they succeeded. Whether that's in terms of the kind of grades they get, if they studied hard and the grade wasn't what we wanted to do, we still need to reward them for that effort, not hold back the rewards because they didn't accomplish what we wanted. They worked hard and they attended practices and they diligently practiced on their own. And then in the goal box, they let the ball get past them. It's okay. They worked hard. We need to reinforce them for that effort. And in fact, the same thing is true when they've tried really hard, and we know they've tried really hard, and we've given them this responsibility to make a decision and made the wrong choice. Now we need to reinforce for them the effort they put in advise them about the mistake they made, and not just rail into them as a punishment. One of the things you got to pay attention to here in terms of this discipline, discipline, is we don't abdicate our responsibility. And too many parents abdicate their responsibility for discipling their children to the media indoctrination that they're getting. You can look up on the internet and you'll find all kind of varieties of numbers and statistics about the amount of information that children get from the internet or even from some specific point. 90%, I read that number, I'm not sure the square number, that some statistics say that teenagers get 90% of their information about the world from TikTok. That's horrifying. Why do we let them spend their time and let those people who have, I don't know, maybe nefarious ideas or maybe no ideas at all in their head, indoctrinate our children? We have the responsibility of discipling them. We need to give them that kind of instruction, particularly in terms of their worldview. What does it mean to be a Christian? How do we understand our relationship with other people? We need to talk to them particularly about the dangers that exist in the world today of sex and drugs. We need to be the ones that's telling them about that instead of letting them get some kind of indoctrination that seems in their mind from the pagan society in which we recently live. That's why Deuteronomy 6, you know, they have these courtyard at Florida College, and they had these bricks, and one time it was fundraiser, you could buy a brick. Of course, we couldn't afford to buy a brick, so we bought a half a brick. Shared it with Phil Roberts. But, you know, you can put your name and your children's name, and you can put something else on there. It wasn't good. But anyway, I chose to put this, Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 6. These words which I command you today shall be in your heart, and you shall teach them diligently to your children, and you shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you sit down, and when you rise up, and you shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be frontlets between your eyes, and you'll write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. And yes, after a while, children get tired of hearing that. Yes, I've heard that before. Well, you're going to hear it again as long as you live in this house. Some parents, of course, they have this misguided idea. We need to wait until the children are old enough to make up their own mind. Are you completely mad? No, we shape them when the bow is young, because when it's older, it's going to take that shape, and you can't easily change it. One mother asked the psychologist, when was the right time to start training your children? And he said, how old is he? And she said, 5. He said, you better hurry up and get home, because you've already missed 5 years already. We start training them even before they leave the womb when we make decisions about the kind of toys we're going to buy for them and the kind of environment we're going to provide for them. We need to take that responsibility instead of abdicating it to the media. Average child in America today spends 60 hours a week in front of a screen. 60 hours a week. And some people say that's impossible. Well, you have on your phones, you know, I'm sure those apps will measure how much time you've had it on. And maybe even will check your face to make sure you're looking at it instead of sleeping there. And you look at that and it'll be amazing how much time we spend on those screens. Plus, you know, the Netflix that we watch, the YouTube videos that we watch, whether on the big screen or the small screen, 60 hours a week. That means by the time a child is 18, they watch 36,000 hours of screen time. They'll spend 15,000 hours in school, maybe another 8,000 in their college studies. They still have match the hours that they spend in terms of media indoctrination. And who knows how many murders they've watched? Somebody suggests 18,000 murders that they have watched, 20,000 sexual episodes they've watched. And somehow we think that doesn't make an impression, even if they're trying not to pay attention. And you know, it's amazing. People will talk about movies and they'll say, you know, it's really not that bad. And then you go to the movie and it's like, oh, are you kidding me? That's not bad. They've been ignored, I guess, or they think it doesn't affect them in some ways. I'm a Christian, so I can watch that stuff and it doesn't bother me. It's not true. It's going to bother you. It's going to affect you. It's going to affect your children, and you need to take charge of that. And you need to be concerned about peer pressure, peer influence. Every single child, parent I know is always asking this question, and children get a little aggravated about it. Who are your friends? Who have you met? You know, who are your roommates when you go off to college? One of the problems is that we have a generation today that is more peer trained than ever before due to the separation of the parents and the child's worlds. As mothers work more, they abdicate the responsibility and let their children be trained by other people. And I'm absolutely flabbergasted when I hear children, and it's not really their fault, they've been allowed to hold on the strap. They will take the advice of a friend their own age that they've known for 3 months over the advice of their parents who for 18 years have labored and slaved and sacrificed for them and demonstrated in 1,000 ways how much they love them and how much they care about them. We need to have a kind of relationship with our children by the time they get that age, that they appreciate our advice and seek it out. But, you know, it starts with early. Even children of 3 years old, they know what kind of shoes they ought to wear. I don't know, where did they get it from? Maybe TikTok, I don't know. They know what their kind of cereal they're supposed to eat. And children grow up with this fear of missing out. So they've got to follow the trends. The only thing that can protect them against that is if we've established a strong relationship with them and their families that gives them some other alternative of information. We need to be careful about this peer influence. Solomon, of course, writes about that a lot in the book of Proverbs. I don't know if you spend much time in Proverbs recently, but if you're a parent, it sounds pretty good. Maybe if you're a child, it sounds even more familiar. You know, my son, don't listen to them. Listen to my words, my son. Trying to steal them away from the influence of their peers, in which they get a lot of trouble. And AI, maybe in this passage of Proverbs, that he's exaggerating things. Of course, parents do that sometimes, but it's really dangerous out there. And we need to advise our children about that and hedge them in as much as possible. And of course, we have to engage in some kind of punishment on occasion. When and how to punish them is one of the questions that people most frequently ask them in terms of this issue of discipline or raising children. And of course, the Bible provides ample admonishment to parents that children need some kind of correction. He who spares his rod hates his son. But if you're loving, you discipline him promptly. And of course, you know, the younger the child is, the more prompt it needs to be. You may be able to say to a 10-year-old, 12-year-old, when we get back home, you know, this is going to happen because of what you're doing and the way you're acting out of the store today. That's not going to work with a 2-year-old. They need to have immediate discipline in order to be able to connect the infraction with the correction. And of course, the modern society, you know, has this sense somehow with the pediatricians and the American Medical Association and the psychologists, they're all very opposed to any kind of corporal punishment whatsoever, maybe even opposed to most any kind of punishment. But the Bible's pretty clear about that. Particularly when we're talking about young children, there's nothing any more effectual than a quick, I don't know, I'm going to get in trouble with this. This is being broadcast where. There's nothing any more effectual than a quick swat to remind the younger child, you are not supposed to do that. I have this vision in my mind. You know, the Italian mama, and she's, you know, stirring up the spaghetti sauce, and the child says something you're not supposed to. Whack! You're not supposed to say that, and goes right back. It happens, it gets their attention, it's corrected, and it's over and done with. You don't want to keep reminding the child in an effort not to have to use physical punishment, and then you spend all this time just yammering at them. I mean, that produces frustration on both parts, whereas the physical punishment gets it done, accomplishes its purposes. Here's this little ditty. Johnny Jr. hit the meter man, Junior bit the cook. Junior's antisocial now, according to the book. Junior smashed the clock and landed. Junior hacked the tree, destructive. Friends are treated in chapters 2 and 3. Junior, said Dad, certifier, whittled Grandpa's pie. That's to gain attention. See page 89. But Grandpa sees the paddle, Yank Jr. across his name. He's read nothing but the Bible since 1953. There's some value to this. And whether we like it in our modern society or not, or whether there are people who violate the appropriate principles of this and end up abusing their children, there still is a need for punishment that takes place in a child's life in order to train them to be self-disciplined. If they don't have some kind of discipline and some kind of correction and even some kind of punishment, they're never going to get there. And then that raises the question that people have, and that is whether or not we should be authoritarian or permissive. As if to think that this complex effort of training children is one-dimensional. Should we be authoritarian and punish them a lot? Or should we be permissive and trust, punish them not at all, or somewhere in between? We have bad news for them. It is not that simple. It's not one-dimensional. It's really probably four-dimensional that we need to pay attention to, according to most of the reasonable child development experts. Four dimensions of raising children, of nurturing them, of training them, of discipling. And those four dimensions, first of all, are nurturance. Every plant needs to be nurtured to grow from the seedling into the full plant. Every child needs to be nurtured, and not just in terms of giving them enough nutrition and the right kind of vegetables and the right kind of vitamins, but nurturing their heart and their soul and their mind. They need to have activities to engage in that stimulate them. They need to have encouragement. We need to tell them that they're worthwhile and create that in them. And some parents are really, really good at nurturing their children. Others are not so good. I kind of recognized this early on, but then it occurred to me, because we used to drive the kids through the circle at elementary school and stop, and they would get out, and they would shut the door. Somebody would take them to their classroom, and you drive on. And so that's like you're in a line. And once you get into the line, you're stuck. You know, a lot of parents are, you know, anxious, drop the kid off so they can get to work on time. And then there are other parents. They pull up, you know, and you can see their car going to park, and then you know, they lean over. You can't see the child. All you see is mother and kid like this. And you can just hear, oh, you're so precious. You don't want to be treated the best little child. You're going to be in this school. They're all going to love you so much. And then the door opens and little pudgy junior. You just leave, lady. Then finally she pulled up. The next one pulls up, car opens, and the child just rolls out. Some parents are nurturing and some are not so nurturing. We need to nurture them. Otherwise, they don't grow. And we need to communicate. We need to talk. And some parents are like this, you know, they talk all the time. They answer all the questions. They're back and forth. Other parents are like, you know, I told you once, that's enough. You know, why do I have to do this? Because I told you to. Other parents, well, it's for this reason and that reason. We need to communicate with them. That's the way in which we create a common understanding, answer their questions, and talk to them. Some parents are better at that than others. And we have maturity demands. What we want to get them from is being dependent children to being self-disciplined adults. And that means that as they grow up and as they mature, there are different levels of responsibility they need to take on. And some parents are real big on that. It's like, grow up and act your age right now. You know, we expect them to act as appropriate to the level of maturity they've reached. Some parents, of course, seem to be pushing them too fast. Others, you know, they don't want them to grow up. Some households are really bad about this. First child, they just push them, you know, into being a grown up as soon as possible. And then the younger child is like, oh no, this is my last precious child. I need to keep him young and dependent on me as long as possible. Well, all of those are obviously wrong and going to have some negative impact. We need to have appropriate levels of maturity demands of expecting them to be able to act according to the level of maturity they've reached. That doesn't necessarily have to do with chronological age. Has to do with the child's temperament as well as the child's age and the way in which we've instructed them. Don't expect them to learn self-discipline when you've not taught them that. Don't expect them to be able to take responsibility when you've not taught them that. And then there's a number of rules. Some parents don't have any rules. Other parents got lots of rules. There's all kinds of rules. When I first started the camp, we had the little 8 year olds said, we need some cabin rules. And I said, let's make up the cabin rules. Boy, they were really good at making up rules. You know, you get all kinds of rules, all kinds of things you didn't think of. Don't spit in anybody else's suitcase. Yeah, they come from households in which there are rules. Some parents even have the rules on the wall, you know, but on the refrigerator. Don't sit in this chair if you have any kind of food or drink. Don't go in this room unless we have guests and you've already taken a shower. Don't talk about the beds. Don't play with this. Don't do that. Don't do the other. It's okay. Some of the parents don't have any rules at all. I remember my kids played with the neighbor boy up the street. And he came home one day, and they were playing what was their my children's favorite game. It's a cushion fortress. You know, they get all the cushions off or all the chairs in the whole house, and they bring them into one room, and they build up a fortress. And then, of course, as they get older, it gets more and more dangerous because somebody will get in the fort, and somebody else will get up on the back of the couch and jump off. Collapse it, you know. And then, I mean, some of you are going to say, obviously, for missing parents. It's my children, I don't think they would say that. But this boy, you know, he looks up and he sees me coming first because they're all busy playing. His eyes get like real big and he backs up against the wall and he said, I didn't want to do it. I told him. Obviously, more rules in his house. And some of you, you know, recognize kids jump on the bed. Others of you recognize as soon as you get out of bed, you got to make the bed and you got to stay off of that bed for the rest of the day until it's night. And that's okay. I mean, some parents have a lot of rules, some they don't. But you can recognize with these four dimensions, some parents emphasize nurturance and communication and let go of the maturity demands and the rules. Other parents only emphasize the maturity demands and the rules, and they don't do the communicating and nurturing that they ought to do. And here's the key. Authoritative parents do all four in the appropriate manner. And there's plenty of room, you know, for variation. But if you're not nurturing your children and communicating with them, just making maturity demands and giving them rules is not going to suffice. And if you are nurturing, communicating, and you're not establishing some kind of maturity demands, that's not going to suffice either. You need to be concerned about all of these. And my suspect and suspicion is many of the kids here will recognize, yeah, my parents did all four of those things. Some will wish that their parents had done more of one and less of the other, but they have, probably. The children are at least halfway grown and halfway self-disciplined. Parents have done most of those things. One more, and I would say love. I've already said affection, but I want to say love so I can get 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 8. Above all things, have fervent love for one another, for love will cover a multitude of sins. As parents, we know that we fail and fall short, and we're not doing all of these things perfectly. But here's the truth of the matter. Children are going to grow up, and they're mostly going to grow up in the right direction if we're making the kind of effort we ought to raise them and nurture the admonition of the Lord. And we make mistakes, but if we love them, and they know that we love them, that makes up for a lot of those mistakes. God bless you in your effort to raise godly children in this godless world in which we live. Appreciate your attention.
Thank you for that rich, rich thoughts, the rich lessons.